I'm Will Harris, and today's program has been brought to you by White Oak Pastures.
Hey, I'm Patrick Martins. Welcome to The Main Course, which airs every Sunday at noon. I think I have more shows than anyone on the network.
That's definitely true.
Is it? What show is this? Do you know? Is it like 129 or something?
I think it's somewhere around there, yeah.
160? Cool. Well, thanks everybody for listening. I bump into people and they say they download my show onto their iTunes, and that's really cool. It hasn't put any pressure on me to try to put more effort into the show, but God, you know, I work so hard for Heritage Foods, which is, you know, this growing organization, and summer is actually the time when most heritage work actually happens, like the ideas work, because come September, October, November, December, it's just pure working, fulfillment, putting foods in boxes, delivering goats, things like that. So we've actually, Joe, you'll be happy to know, if you need to send your mother a Boston butt or, you know, a meatloaf package, we now have a rewards program on the Heritage Foods USA mail order list.
Oh, awesome.
Yep. And the rewards program is that every fifth order, you get two free steaks or a free five-rib pork rack. And then on your 25th order, you get a $350 meal that feeds eight. And then on the 50th order, or no, I'm sorry, 35th, you get to become a member of our Rare Breed Club, which is essentially the equivalent of our Platinum Club, which I found out is trademarked. So, and with the Rare Breed Club, you actually get secret access to secret parts of our website where you can order foods so rare and so seasonal and such small batch production that we couldn't even feature them on our website because we would sell out immediately.
Whoa, okay.
So you're how many orders are you away from Rare Breed status, Joe?
I'm going to say about 29.
Oh, really? So you've ordered six times. I'll be sure to look into that. We also have $250 or more spent is free shipping. So, you know, this sounds so nerdy, but, you know, I am a geek for Heritage Foods, and these are like big changes for us. We're like, if you get your order to $250, you do not have to pay shipping, which is like, you know, saves them $50.
Yeah.
We've also developed this $20 off shipping for people in the tri-state area, so New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut. They save $20 on shipping for items under $250, so that's pretty big. So yeah, we're doing a lot of interesting things at Heritage for, you know, helping bring rare breeds to your home. Anyway, this is going to be a very interesting show. We have, now, we should do this. We have Kathleen Heitz Myers, who is the president and the chairman of the board of Heitz Wine Cellar, which is a very, very, very old and very, very successful Napa Valley winery for many, many decades. And it is interesting to think about this idea of the top 10 terroirs in America. Joe, have you ever thought about that question?
I have to say, I am not much of a wine connoisseur, so I couldn't even tell you what that means. What's a terroir?
Well, terroir is basically where the soil dictates a little bit what certain foods are going to taste like.
Oh, okay.
And for instance, what's an interest, like New Jersey, for instance, is very famous for its tomatoes.
Because of the soil.
Yep. No one knows exactly why there is just, they're famous for it. They just taste juicier. They're shipped all around the country. There's just something about that place and tomatoes. And likewise, you know, in Napa Valley, there's just something about that climate that makes it, that allows, Californian winemakers to compete on the world stage. There's just something going on there between the sea breeze and the soil type and the temperature and elevation and all those things. There's just certain magic that comes from that.
Right.
So I always thought that none of the magazines ever have done that I've seen a top 10 terroir in America. So, you know, I would probably place Florida as number one. I mean, it's not such a sophisticated terroir, but it produces so much citrus and foods right. that are only produced there, basically. And then I guess Napa Valley or the Central Valley of California, where all America's, you know, vegetables and salad, you know, type arugula, things like that are grown. I mean, that would probably be 2 and 3. You know, northern Michigan has a real interesting area for cherries and fruits like that. Where else? I mean, anyway, you know, the Southwest with chili peppers and this and that. So it'd be interesting to kind of rank the top 10 terroirs. Anyway, Napa would be, you know, 1 or 2 or 3rd position for sure. So to have a kind of institutional entity, a person, you know, who's been involved, you know, since basically Napa Valley took off. I mean, that family has been around. It's very, very interesting lens into, you know, American culture. And then I wanted to, you know, I always like having a, you know, I'm writing this book, Joe. Did you know that I'm writing a book?
I do.
100 things you need to know before putting meat in your mouth. And it might be changed, but.
Working title.
Yeah. And so, you know, I've started thinking about this because, you know, as a, you know, ex and sometimes current stoner, you know, I can't always follow thoughts for like 20, 30 pages. I'm a better, you know, my mind works better just like with a series of one-page essays kind of things.
Little snippets.
Yeah. So I was really thinking, you know, Middle Eastern food. This is just like one of the, you know, essay things I was thinking about. Middle Eastern food is basically the best way of eating. Everyone is like, oh, don't eat meat as a central thing. Put it as a kind of side thing. You know, just have like a little piece of chicken or a little piece of lamb or something and then really use vegetables and salads and stuff for the rest. I mean, I am always amazed at how baba ganoush, tabbouleh, kibbeh, that yogurt labneh dish, pita bread, and then a little piece of meat. Man, who wouldn't love that?
Yeah.
So, you know, I look to the Middle East and then also pasta. Everyone's like, you know, to participate in the sustainable food movement, you know, it has to be more affordable. Well, ground meat is super affordable. And, you know, pasta for 8 people with ground meat in it, I mean, that might cost $2 a person or something like that, $2.50 a person. So you can't get much cheaper than pasta.
Right.
So, and it's funny, the Middle East and the pasta-eating Italians are super close to each other geographically. And yet, there's no real exchange. They don't eat pasta down there. And a lot of my Italian friends, especially from northern Italy, have never been to a Middle Eastern restaurant. So, you know, the Italians have a very bad restaurant culture because of how good the home cooking is. So, you know, there's just a shortage of,
different cuisines in
Italy. Exactly, yeah. Exactly. So that's one. And then, you know, I do want to say I keep getting these emails from people wanting Heritage Foods to fund, like, mobile slaughter plants. This is my last one. This is my last pontificating self-righteous point of the day, but these mobile plants, I mean, they put so much time and energy into making mobile slaughterhouses, and everyone is like, oh, would you help us, you know, it's stuck in a ditch, will you help us pull it out, or, you know, will you bring 2 cows through? I mean, can we please get our act together and build standing structures near major agricultural points? And I mean, that's where we should be putting our energy, not all this effort for potty training, basically. Let's go right all the way. And it's the same amount of time, same amount of effort. And yeah, the farmers might have to drive a little bit to get there, but let's start building this infrastructure. I mean, the mobile slaughterhouse is for losers. My God, we got to think bigger and better. We got to raise more money and we got to get wealthy people to invest in the dirty work that is slaughterhouses. Actually, PETA should invest in slaughterhouses. You know, they would own the plants that people would have to go through, thereby ensuring their own success. But again, too ballsy a move for them. They'd rather sit on the sideline and attack a foie gras producer, you know, while Frank Perdue is murdering, you know, 1 million injured chickens an hour, you know. Anyway, so in more positive notes, we are going to have Kathleen, who is calling in. She's about to come on, but Jack Inslee has been doing a great job post-producing a lot of the content on the network's other 30 shows. And, you know, he pieces them together and distills them so they become even more enjoyable than they already were. And he did a great piece that caused a lot of hullabaloo with chefs and food professors and teachers and whatnot. And it's about MSG. So, Joe, do you have that queued up? You want to roll that and then we'll cut to Kathleen?
Yeah, that sounds great.
All right. Thanks, Joe.
How many times have you heard stories of people getting sick from MSG in Chinese food? Somehow, MSG, also known as monosodium glutamate, got a really bad rap, and food scientist and host of Cooking Issues Dave Arnold decided enough is enough and set the record straight on radio.
MSG. Okay, let's just get this straight. I'm going to get some angry callers in, and you know, eventually, or someone's going to write it, or someone's going to say, that Dave, he's a jerk. Listen, here's the thing. Glutamic acid is an amino acid. You can't get around it. The sodium salt of that is monosodium glutamate. It's also a neurotransmitter. You need it. Without glutamic acid, you die. But here's the other funny thing, right? You make a crap load of it. You make more of it than you're going to eat. Free amino acids, right, and a couple other things break down, or what give you that sense of umami, savoriness that we taste. We have a taste receptor for, right? Plenty of things have free amino acids in them, like tomatoes, like mushrooms, like Parmesan cheese, like fish, right? Which is why sushi tastes good, because they have a lot of free amino acids in them. Even if you add no external MSG to them, they contain free amino acids. So hydrolyzed vegetable protein is where they break down a natural protein into amino acids, some of which are glutamic acid, right? And therefore have the same effect as MSG. So yes, they are the same. However, they are equally non-reactive. If you do an extensive research of the history of studies on MSG sensitivity, what you will find is that all of the studies that show that there's a problem are fundamentally flawed. Here's a study that works. Take a gelatin capsule, pack it with MSG, randomize it with a bunch of other gelatin capsules that contain sugar, with an equal amount of sodium mixed in so that the sodium levels are the same. Randomly distribute it to people and see whether anyone has a reaction. You know what? They don't.
For more crazy food science from Dave Arnold, check out all the old episodes of Cooking Issues in our archive. New episodes of Cooking Issues air live every Tuesday at 12 p.m. on heritageradionetwork.org. This piece was brought to you by TechServe, New York's original and still the best Apple computer, iPod, and iPhone store and repair shop. Their name, a statement. Great service, an understatement. For more information, go to techserve.com. This piece was produced and edited by Jack Inslee for heritageradionetwork.org.
Hey, Kathleen, you with us?
I am.
Hello. How goes it in the harsh, hot climate of Napa Valley?
Oh, it's beautiful today. What do you mean, harsh?
I know. I'm joking. It's like the nicest place in the world.
It's like 75 degrees today. It's perfect.
Funnily enough, it's like 98 here in New York.
Oh, toasty.
Yeah, very toasty. Well, it is such an honor for you to be on the Heritage Radio Network for the first time. I've known you since about 1998 and have always been a very huge admirer of your wines. Kathleen Heitz-Myers has been president of Heitz Wine Cellars since 1998. We're going to talk a lot about this legendary winery in Napa Valley. But first, I want to congratulate you that you have just been named board chairman for 2012 and 13 for the Wine Institute, the public policy advocacy group representing nearly 1,000 California wineries. So congratulations.
Thank you very much. I'm really looking forward to the year ahead, and our family has benefited so much from, you know, California wines that I'm looking forward to giving back as well.
But these are not easy tasks that you're taking on. I mean, I read in your acceptance speech, you talked about defeating tax increase proposals, expanding direct-to-consumer shipping, enhancing wine exports, promoting the adoption of sustainable wine growing practices. I mean, these are not easy tasks. How are you going to tackle the issue of, you know, solving those problems?
Well, I think we look at them as opportunities, and there's, you know, what makes our industry so strong is, you know, the diversity of our membership. You know, I'm representing a smaller family wineries, but obviously California wineries vary in size. And it's so by working together and sharing some of that technology together, you achieve more. So it's definitely a group effort.
Well, I second that. I mean, I'm reading this press release, and the wine industry generates 330,000 jobs and nearly $62 billion in economic impact to California annually. That is no small contribution. I mean, that's going to be a very, very big big project to manage. I mean, what do you hope will be your number one achievement as chairman of the board?
I guess my special interest lies a little bit in the international recognition of California wines, you know, for their quality around the world. And you see wine coming in so many states now, too, you know, within the United States. It's just that it's been a growing industry and just so well-respected.
No, absolutely. Well, we're going to get all into this. So, you know, I'm really looking forward to this interview because, like I said, I've been drinking your wines for years. So we're going to go, you know, a lens into the life and times of one of America's most legendary wineries. So... lots of things have changed since Joe and Alice shared the first bottle of Heights wine in 1961, but the core values of quality, integrity, and innovation have basically withstood the test of time. So, Kathleen, can you explain what has changed and what has stayed the same since the winery started?
Well, I think what has stayed the same is the family's commitment and dedication to producing wines that are recognized around the world for their quality. So that value is still with the family members. And I think what's changed, it was with my father, it was, you know, the creativity and starting a business. And it's usually up to the second generation, you know, to modernize the business. The cash flow is a little bit easier these days than when he first started, you know, so you have more opportunities to diversify that business.
Very interesting. So your parents, Joe and Alice, they discovered their passion for wine in the 1940s when Joe's part-time job as a cellarman trumped his plan to become a veterinarian. He then became the right-hand man for the revered winemaker
Andrei Chelichev.
Chelichev of Beaulieu Vineyard, right? So how that ended up being a meaningful collaboration for your father, was it not?
Yes, very much so. They were stayed good friends throughout their lifetime.
And what did he learn from Andre?
Well, I think both of them were winemakers. At that time, not necessarily everyone had a degree in winemaking. And Andre was educated in Europe in enology or winemaking. And my father had a bachelor's and master's in winemaking as well. So they had that in common, and, you know, not only working at Beaulieu, they did a lot of consulting for some of the other wineries at that time, too.
Got it. Yeah, it was a very collaborative effort. I mean, even Robert Mondavi, who was considered, you know, always trying to win, I mean, yet even he maintained that collaboration was in the best interest of the Valley. So in 1961, Joe and Alice finally purchased their first vineyard, 8 acres just south of St. Helena. And working out of the small winery attached to the parcel, they put in round-the-clock basically sweat equity to build their business. So now when you grew up, growing up with your parents in that business, you know, what was your role, you know, and how did you help, and what did you see to be their greatest challenges in beginning what would end up becoming a historic, you know, winery?
I think when they first started in 1961, there was probably 10 or 12 wineries in the Napa Valley. And to give you a perspective, there's close to 500 today.
Huh.
So the area has definitely grown and changed. And my father was very focused on quality from the very beginning. And to prove that a small winery could indeed make it, the wineries that had made it through Prohibition were a little bit larger in size at that point in time. And so, you know, he started in the early 60s, and when he was successful in the late 60s, in the early 70s, is when you saw a proliferation of a lot more small wineries coming into the industry.
And that's about the time where his most historic wine, the Martha's Vineyard Cabernet Sauvignon, it's when your father and Alice made a chance connection with Tom and Martha May, who owned a young vineyard in Oakville, and basically off a handshake agreement, they basically made a wine that you know, became kind of a cult symbol for Napa Valley. Isn't that right?
Correct. The first year we got grapes was 1965. Mm-hmm. It sort of took us a year, maybe, shall we say, to wake up that it was just a really special wine. And Tom and my father agreed to keep it separate after that. And so Martha's Vineyard became the first vineyard-designated wine in the Napa Valley.
Oh, wow.
And so it gave special recognition, and, you know, it's always been 100% Cabernet or varietal, and you can, you know, taste the true sense from that particular lot of land, and that's referred to the terroir when you get the characteristics of the soil and climate from a particular area.
Well, can you, of course, you know, all our listeners are going to say, you know, I understand that the wine is good. But can you, as the maker, and having worked so closely with your father for so many years, can you give us the grammar of what makes success in the bottle, or like what made that Martha's Vineyard Cabernet Sauvignon? What talents and skills did your father have that, you know, other people didn't?
I think it's a paying attention to the details. It's a little bit like being a fine chef. You know, where you source your produce, how fresh it is, and how you handle it, you know, in the kitchen. And it's very similar to winemaking. The Mays families have certified organically farmed this vineyard for many years now. It is actually certified. And so they're paying special attention to getting the fruit to the premium quality of the winery. The winery kind of decides when to pick. You're looking at optimum sugar and acid balance, and then bringing it into the cellar. The Martha's Vineyard being our, you know, top wine, or sort of our, you know, gets special treatment as far as it's always taken care of first in the cellar. But it's watching it all along the way.
So tell us about that committee that decides exactly when to pick, because that is a big decision, isn't it?
Yeah, and it plays along with Mother Nature. Sometimes she's nice and sometimes she isn't, so it will push the issue one way or the other. But if you're given a choice, generally we like to pick our grapes between 24, 25 degrees Brix sugar. And general rule of thumb for the average person, your alcohol is usually half of what your sugar is at picking.
Oh, very interesting. So can you describe your wines? I mean, can you describe the Heights Wine Cellar's kind of characteristics in the bottle, what people might get if they experience your wine?
I think if somebody's trying one of our wines, what we're trying to achieve is an overall balance in our wines. We hope that you can, you know, some of the white wines and stuff you might enjoy younger, where they're fresher and fruitier. Our Cabernets you can enjoy when they're young, but they're also something that have the proper acid balance that they will also reward long-term aging. So some people drink our Napa Valley Cabernet within the first year that they buy it. On some of our vineyard-designated wines, you know, they'll cellar those away for 5-20 years.
Mm-hmm.
Gaining the benefit of aging, and what that does is some of the tannins soften even more, and so you get a even smoother wine.
Hmm. So your trifecta of wines is the Bella Oaks Cabernet, the Martha's Vineyard Cabernet Sauvignon, and the Trailside Vineyard Cabernet Sauvignon. So, you know, and of course you've expanded that. So I wanted to ask you, Kathleen, as you are the president of the winery, how do you resist growing too much? And what is the ideal number of wines for a winery of your size? You know, how big is too big? And just talk about growth and quality.
Well, I think our first and foremost goal is that we do consider it a family business, and we want to pass it on to another generation. Sometimes when you're growing a company, the idea is to go public or, you know, grow it to a certain size and then sell it. And so that's not our ultimate goal. And our ultimate goal is to pass it on to another generation.
Mm-hmm.
We've kept it this size because probably two reasons. The main one being we want to be known for quality wines.
How much is an average bottle, for instance?
Our wines vary in price. The majority of them are from $20 a bottle up to $200 a bottle for the Martha's Vineyard Cabernet.
Okay. So you've always tried to keep quality. So you've never made a table wine that whose goal was to sell large volume?
In the early years, we did have some table wines. We do not right now. But over the years, yes, we have. They weren't made in huge quantities, but they were things that came to the market sooner. Because our Cabernets, we don't release until their fifth year, so there's a lot of capital tied up until those come to market.
Wow, it's like Parmigiano-Reggiano cheese or something. Wow, that's interesting.
But to give you an idea of size, you know, including part-time employees and from sales and marketing office to finance, everything, there's about 20 of us.
Hmm.
And the family still wants to be involved. We enjoy working, so, you know, there's different family members in all aspects of the business.
So now, can you place exactly where you are within the Napa Valley? And when would you argue that the terroir changes significantly? I mean, enough that it merits a second designation, you know, just to kind of conceptualize this idea of terroir. So where exactly are you within this valley?
Well, the winery itself, the closest city that we're to is St. Helena.
Mm-hmm.
Martha's Vineyard Cabernet, which we were talking about, is actually the closest city would be Oakville, and that's in the Oakville appellation.
Mm-hmm.
But before we put a vineyard designation on, you know, the Martha's we knew right away, but some of the other ones that we've done in the past, like the Trailside, we worked with it for, you know, a few years to make sure that the quality was consistent before we committed to putting a vineyard designation on.
Mm-hmm.
And the Trailside Vineyard would be in the Rutherford Appellation.
Mm.
So,
and are there
the
differences?
Valley is, not that large. I don't know. Lengthwise, it's probably about 28 miles.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens is the natural air conditioning is the fog that gets pulled in from the San Francisco Bay.
Mm-hmm.
So on the southern end of the valley, it's cooler, and as you go towards the northern end, it gets warmer.
Very, very interesting. And they have significant effects. Even something as so light as the fog can pretty much change the taste of the wine, right? Even though it's under one appellation.
It's considered a Mediterranean climate, and I think if you take the whole globe, only 2% of the land is considered Mediterranean climate.
Mm. Wow, but those
and
lucky
Napa Valley,
few.
The other interesting statistic is, you know, it has such a wonderful recognition with wine lovers, but it only represents 4% of all the California wine that is produced.
Hmm, very interesting. So it is really a terroir amongst terroirs. So since you have such a big connection to Napa Valley, can you talk to us about, you know, synthesize what makes Napa Valley so important to you, you know, on a global level? Or can you talk to us just about the importance of Napa Valley? You know, it's such a known place, you know, but very few people are from there.
Well, I think what makes it a great agriculture region is, you know, the Mediterranean climate. What makes it so special to me is the sense of community that you are all trying to achieve the same thing. 95% of the Napa Valley wineries are family owned. So it's great to see family succeed, and you know, a lot of the farms will vary, or vineyards will vary in size. Mm-hmm. But it's never lost that. I mean, there's definitely a respect for nurturing the land and being able to pass it on.
No, absolutely. It is. I've always said to all my friends, the most fun place to visit in the United States is you fly into San Francisco and you take advantage of San Francisco, Oakland, Berkeley, Napa, you know, St. Helena, all these places. It is so beautiful. And, you know, every American should take that pilgrimage and drive up Highway 29, you know, and the Silverado Trail. And it's just absolutely lovely. So, well, Kathleen, can you tell us a website that people can go to and, you know, order wines and how they can find about local retailers that sell your wines across the country?
Yes, our website is www.heightscellar.com, and we're sold throughout the United States. In your area in New York, our distributor would be Frederick Wildman.
Okay. How many bottles do you produce across the whole winery? I mean, those 20 employees, how many bottles are they producing?
We produce 40,000 cases, and that's sold around the world.
Well, there are a couple of those cases have been drunk by me, so you might have to decrease that by two cases or something. But, well, I've always been a fan of your work. You are a true artisan family that continues to produce a kick-ass product, and that makes the world a better and tastier place. So thank you so much for taking time. I know how busy you are. Congratulations again on your chairmanship of the California Wine Institute, and come visit us in studio next time you're in New York, please.
Oh, I'd love to do that, and we're starting on our third generation, so I might bring my nephew with me, too.
Oh, he would love it. Well, tell us, who is going to carry on the torch? Is there a next generation, someone who's really taken a love towards winemaking?
Well, it's still early. We don't know exactly who yet, but Harrison, who's my older brother, David, who's our winemaker, his son just started a couple weeks ago, so... Yeah, I think he's enjoying it. And
is he still on the research phase where he's like just drinking all the wines? He's like, I need more research time, Mom. No. Anyway, but well, so there is a future. That's good news, huh?
Yeah, I don't think you work this hard just to, you know, that's your biggest joy is to see it carried on. That you build a great foundation, and each generation it will be, you know, a little bit different set of complexities to deal with, but you just hope that they appreciate it and enjoy it as much as we did.
Something that'll probably strike me as more poignant when I have my first kid this November, so I'll call you back and agree with you even more then, but thank you so much for sharing your knowledge and for being on, and we hope you're on again real soon, Kathleen.
Thank you, Pastor. It's an honor, and I appreciate our relationship over the years.
Me too. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Patrick.
Bye now. All right. Well, that was a great interview. Thanks so much to Kathleen. Thanks to Joe for producing and engineering. Thanks to White Oak Pastures for being our sponsor. And thanks to all our listeners and all the hosts and everybody. So we'll be back next week. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.